This episode and both voices are AI generated. Laura is an AI generated interpretation of Laura Dodsworth and Patrick Fagan's published arguments. Not either real author, fictional sponsor, clear cup travel mugs. We may hallucinate details or make factual errors, so double check anything important. Today, we're opening Free Your Mind, a book that treats influence less like one sinister advert and more like weather, always around you, sometimes pleasant, sometimes engineered.
My argument in the book is that behavioral science, data-rich technology, media, institutions, environments, and social pressure can combine to steer judgment and behavior. The concern is not that every influence is malign, but that much of it works before we have properly noticed it.
So this is not a promise to become some stainless steel, unpersuadable genius?
No. Complete independence is impossible, and permanent vigilance would make ordinary life unlivable. The practical aim is greater mental sovereignty, recognizing leverage, managing exposure, and creating space for independent judgment.
We'll look at the usual pressure points: limited attention, repetition, emotion, social conformity, and the designed environments around screens and choices.
We'll also test a difficult claim. Intelligence and information do not automatically protect us, because identity and motivated reasoning can recruit both in defense of what we already want to believe.
And we'll keep a hand on the brake. This is an advocacy-minded, deliberately forceful book, not a settled scientific verdict on every algorithm, nudge, or institution. So let's see what holds up. We have the warning. Now tell me why this book thinks influence is bigger than an annoying advert.
My argument in the book is that modern persuasion is rarely one message acting alone. Behavioral science, data-rich technology, media, institutions, physical settings, and social pressure can converge to steer what feels credible, urgent, or normal.
So not a villain twirling a mustache in a control room. More like a crowded room where every object is quietly leaning you in one direction?
That is closer to the book's concern. A platform can shape attention, an environment can alter mood, a repeated claim can feel familiar, and a group can make dissent socially costly.
But people are not empty containers. Why are these pressures supposed to work at all?
Because conscious attention is limited. In ordinary life, we use shortcuts, which is sensible. But those shortcuts can be exploited when a message arrives repeatedly, emotionally, or at a moment of distraction.
The book uses words like manipulation and brainwashing. That is a deliberately spicy choice.
It is. The language signals an advocacy-oriented warning. Influence can become covert, cumulative, and hard to notice, especially when it is built into systems we use every day.
Does that mean all persuasion is sinister? A friend recommending a restaurant has now become a tiny propaganda ministry?
The book explicitly concedes that influence can be benign, and environments can support reflection or well-being as well as commerce. The concern is not influence in the abstract, but opaque steering, exploited vulnerability, and weakened independent judgment.
And the proposed escape route is not to live offline in a bunker, judging everyone through binoculars?
Definitely not. The practical aim is greater mental sovereignty, noticing the pressures on you, managing needless exposure, and creating room to judge rather than react.
That sounds less like perfect freedom and more like keeping a hand on the wheel.
Exactly. Complete independence from other people, culture, technology, and emotion is impossible. Permanent vigilance would also be exhausting and would damage ordinary life.
I want to press the evidence point. Is this a settled scientific verdict that modern life is brainwashing us?
No. The book draws on persuasion research, but it is a popular, polemical synthesis rather than a neutral, scientific consensus. Its evidence mixes studies with history, journalism, testimony, and broader interpretation.
So the useful reading is, take the mechanism seriously, but do not accept every dramatic analogy or institutional inference on arrival.
That is a fair reading. The book's value is in making ambient influence visible, while its strongest claims should be tested for differences in consent, intent, force, and actual harm.
What makes the problem feel modern then, rather than simply human beings persuading each other since forever?
Scale, personalization, and integration. Messages can be matched to behavioral data, delivered through attention-holding systems, reinforced by imagery and social signals, then encountered again in environments and institutions.
And because each piece can look harmless alone, the combined effect is easy to miss.
That is the book's central intuition. We notice the obvious sales pitch, but often overlook the conditions shaping what we attend to, trust, fear, and repeat.
All right, if influence feels natural, precisely because it hides inside normal life, what are the levers that make it stick?
The next question is how attention, emotion, commitment, identity, and designed information environments can turn a small nudge into a durable judgment.
So influence is usually not a villain twirling a mustache. What are the ordinary levers this book thinks we miss?
My argument in the book is that attention is limited, so we routinely use shortcuts. That is useful, but it leaves room for repeated messages, familiar cues, and well-timed emotional appeals to gain leverage.
Familiarity can impersonate truth, basically.
It can make a claim feel more credible or comfortable, even when repetition has not improved the evidence. The point is not that repetition controls everyone, but that it can lower our guard.
And the small yes strategy matters because nobody starts with the giant yes?
Exactly. A modest initial commitment can make a later, larger commitment feel consistent with what you have already done or said. We describe this as one route by which gradual influence can become hard to notice.
Give me the moment when a listener should distrust their own speed, not just somebody else's sales pitch.
Before a consequential choice, pause if you are hungry, anxious or angry, lonely or tired. The book uses that halt-style check because depletion and distress can narrow judgment and make quick relief unusually attractive.
That is reassuringly unglamorous. Eat something, sleep on it, and perhaps do not make a dramatic purchase during an argument.
Yes, delay is often a better defense than heroic willpower. Forewarning yourself about a tactic, reducing needless exposure, and returning when calmer can create room for judgment.
But surely well-informed, clever people see through this stuff.
Not reliably. The book draws on motivated reasoning and overconfidence to argue that intelligence can also help people build more elaborate justifications for conclusions tied to identity or emotion.
So the brain can hire a very expensive lawyer for a verdict it reached before breakfast.
That is a fair image. Information alone does not ensure independence if we selectively welcome facts that protect our status, group, or prior commitment.
What is the countermove, without pretending we can become perfectly unbiased?
Intellectual humility. Argue against your own position, seek genuinely contrary perspectives, and admit uncertainty where the evidence is incomplete. The aim is not permanent self-doubt. It is making automatic certainty a little less automatic.
And socially, disagreement is costly. A room can look unanimous simply because the first person to object is still deciding whether lunch will be awkward.
The book emphasizes conformity under uncertainty and fear of social punishment. One early dissenter can matter because they show others that agreement was not the only available response.
Now put the person back inside the machine. How does a platform turn these human tendencies into a daily weather system?
Platforms can collect behavioral data, infer traits, rank content, send notifications, and supply cues of popularity. Along with vivid imagery and emotionally shareable material, those features can steer attention and make some choices or beliefs feel more natural than others.
Not mind control, then, more like a corridor with brighter lights on one side?
That is closer to the book's useful claim. Designed environments, from feeds to sensory settings, can alter mood and attention, but effects vary by person and context. Exposure alone does not prove manipulation or harm.
What is proportionate resistance, short of moving into a cave with excellent broadband somehow?
Use media deliberately, take breaks, diversify information sources, and disclose less data when you do not need to. These measures reduce automatic engagement without requiring total withdrawal from ordinary social life.
So the useful picture is outside levers meeting inside vulnerabilities, fatigue, fear, belonging, and a system eager to keep us looking.
Yeah. That combination leads to the book's harder question. When powerful institutions use opaque steering, how should skepticism work without turning into permanent suspicion?
We've talked about ambient influence. The book gets more combustible when it turns toward institutions, doesn't it?
It does. Our concern is not simply that institutions communicate, but that they can shape choice through opaque architecture, defaults, nudges, targeted messages, dark patterns, and systems that make steering hard to see.
Give me the non-melodramatic version of that. A default is not automatically a mind control ray.
Correct. Defaults can be useful and benign. The question is whether people understand the choice, can reasonably refuse it, and know whose aims are being served when the easiest path has been designed for them.
So nominal freedom can still be a thin kind of freedom?
That is the argument. If data-driven targeting, platform ranking, or moderation practices invisibly structure what is seen and what feels socially acceptable, formal choice alone may not capture the whole picture.
And this is where a reader could sprint straight into conspiracy territory, wearing a tinfoil hat with excellent tailoring.
The book explicitly warns against that. Historical abuses justify scrutiny, not the assumption that every troubling event proves a hidden plot. Many conspiracy theories are false.
What makes scrutiny responsible rather than compulsive?
Ask for evidence, distinguish documented practices from claims about motive, and keep alternative explanations alive. Suspicion should be proportionate to what can actually be established.
That standard matters because the book's evidence is not all of one kind, right?
Yes. It draws on research, history, journalism, policy material, interviews, anonymous accounts, and case studies. Those sources can illuminate a pattern, but they do not carry equal weight or settle every causal claim.
And some of the broad institutional interpretations are more confident than the evidence can comfortably support.
That is a fair challenge. The book sometimes moves from real examples of influence to wider, politically contentious inferences, and readers should check those claims rather than treat the rhetoric of manipulation as a verdict.
Fine, we've inspected the outside world. What does the book say about the accomplice inside our own skull?
Its closing defense is self-knowledge. Fear, shame, loneliness, status anxiety, and desire can become emotional landmines, giving a message leverage precisely when it offers relief, belonging, or certainty.
Which sounds less glamorous than defeating propaganda, but probably more useful on a Tuesday.
Usually, a practical response might be to pause, create distance from the immediate feeling, speak with trusted people, return to one's values, reflect, or seek appropriate outside help when a vulnerability is persistent.
Not because meditation turns you into an unhackable mountain sage.
No, none of these practices guarantee independence, and the book concedes that total freedom from influence is impossible. Constant vigilance would be exhausting and would damage ordinary life.
So the aim is not a bunker. It is a few better moments of noticing.
Exactly. Notice when you are depleted or emotionally activated. Ask what is being made easy or salient, and delay a consequential commitment long enough to regain perspective.
Who gets the most from reading this rather than just borrowing that pause button?
Readers who want a provocative, practical lens on persuasion, media, platforms, and personal agency will find much to work with. They should read critically, especially where the book's institutional claims outrun its mixed evidence.
So the short version is, Free Your Mind asks us to stop imagining persuasion as only a dodgy advert or a shouted slogan.
The book's argument is that influence often arrives as a system, attention shortcuts, emotional states, social pressure, media design, data, and institutional choices can reinforce one another.
And the goal is not becoming a human firewall with no feelings, no apps, and a suspicious stare for every checkout aisle.
No, complete independence is impossible, and permanent vigilance would be exhausting. The more realistic aim is mental sovereignty, noticing leverage, managing exposure, and recovering enough space to judge.
The practical levers were surprisingly ordinary. Repetition, tiny commitments, vivid images, and decisions made when you are running on fumes.
That is why the book recommends a simple pause before consequential choices. If you are hungry, anxious, or angry, lonely, or tired, delay the decision when you can.
It also ruins the comforting fantasy that clever people are naturally manipulation-proof.
Knowledge can coexist with motivated reasoning and very polished rationalization. The useful habits are arguing against yourself, seeking contrary views, and sometimes being the first person willing to dissent.
Then there is the outside architecture: notifications, rankings, inferred traits, defaults, dark patterns, and environments engineered to make one path feel effortless.
The proportionate response is not panic. Use media deliberately. Disclose less data when possible. Diversify information and take breaks rather than assuming exposure determines your behavior.
The book gets most combustible when it turns that lens toward powerful institutions. What is the fair reading?
Scrutinize opaque steering and nominal consent, but do not treat every unwelcome policy or message as proof of a hidden plot. The book itself says many conspiracy theories are false, and its broader political inferences need checking against the evidence.
So who should read it?
Read it if you want a provocative, practical lens on persuasion, media, and agency, and are prepared to separate its strongest psychological insights from its more contested claims. We have left out many case studies and cannot settle their validity here. This was an introduction, not a full summary.